This is Audible.
Podium Audio presents Breakaway, Book 12 of Expeditionary Force, written by Craig Allenson, performed by R.C. Bray. Chapter 1. The Rindaloo heavy cruiser Spear of Rantalos hung motionless in space relative to the Jarapha Ethics and Compliance Office ship Will Do Sketchy Things, both ships having completed exhaustive sensor sweeps of the battle area. To describe the action that took place there as a battle was inaccurate. It was a slaughter. The senior surviving officer of the ECO ship We Were Never Here was Commander Zelene Fentanyl, and she did not have anything useful to report. The second group of Jarapha ships that were awaiting transfer to the humans had been ambushed by an overwhelming force of Maxalt's warships without warning. All of the ships designated for transfer were systematically destroyed, along with the star carriers they were attached to and their frontline escort vessels. The attack had been a complete shock, but what truly concerned Captain Ottavio Scarandum of the Ethics and Compliance Office was why had the humans never arrived at the rendezvous point. They were supposed to meet the second group of ships to take possession and guide the star carriers to the remote, inaccessible forward operating base the humans had established at the edge of the galaxy. If the human ship Valkyrie had suffered a horrible fate, the balance of power in the galaxy might abruptly change again. Scarandum's head was still spinning from learning that humans were flying the fearsome ghost ship and that humans had a cache of Elder weapons. The most shocking news of all was that humans had been flying around the galaxy for years, doing all kinds of awesomely sketchy things without ECO being involved or even knowing humans were players. Clearly, the Ethics and Compliance Office needed to seriously step up its game. Captain Scarandum, the Rindaloo official representative aboard the advanced technology warship glared as she appeared on the bridge display of the Will-Do Sketchy Things. We demand an explanation.
Yes, thank you.
Scarandum breathed an exaggerated sigh of relief.
Excellent, then...
Wait, what?
We also demand an explanation for this outrage.
Scarandum shook his head sadly.
When you get that explanation from the devious Maxalks, please pass it along to us.
From the...
The spider's hideous mouth gaped open. We also wish for an apology.
The Maxalks do not apologize to any...
You misunderstand me. We wish for an apology from you.
From us? The spider screeched. Even through the translator, the sound made Scarandum's leathery skin crawl.
Of course. Under our mutual defense treaty, you are required to defend us against attacks by your counterparts. This was a direct assault by a senior species force against a second-tier client species of your coalition. You failed to protect us. No doubt you are deeply ashamed by your failure and will compensate us by...
Captain Scarandum!
The explanation we demand is how a group of your ships came to be here after we expressly forbid you to transfer more ships to the humans and after you claimed this same group of ships was mysteriously stolen.
Oh? It seems fairly obvious to me.
It seems obvious to us also. We await your apology.
An apology from us?
Scarandum's main antennas dipped low over his eyes. Clearly, the Maxalks stole those ships.
The...
You are claiming the Maxalks stole the ships from you, then brought them all the way here before destroying them? That makes no sense!
The methods of the enemy are inscrutable, certainly, the ECO captain sighed. That is why we depend on our exalted patrons, the Rindaloo, to warn us of impending danger and to protect us, which, I am reluctant to mention again, you failed to do.
If the ships were indeed stolen from you, then please explain why one of your ships, the We Were Never Here, was found among the wreckage.
Scarandum blinked.
Well, that also seems fairly obvious.
Really? The spider's voice dripped with scorn.
We await your rationale for that. Clearly, Commander Fentanyl of the We Were Never Here discovered the theft in progress and bravely followed the enemy here to determine their intentions. Sadly, the heroic efforts of her crew were unable to overcome the heinous perfidy of the enemy. Before she could report her findings to you, her ship was destroyed. That is your story? The spider was incredulous. Honored representative, I do not see any other possible explanation. You do not? Scarandum shook his head, his antennas flopping side to side. No. How about this? Those ships were never stolen. They were here, waiting for the humans to meet you. But instead, the Maxulks discovered your plan and destroyed the ships before the humans could use them against all of us. That is a shocking and hurtful accusation. Scarandum hung his head, his antennas drooping. It also does not account for the facts. What facts? If the humans were supposed to meet us here, where are they? We found no evidence any human ship was ever here. Well, the spider's eyes blinked. I mean, unless you found evidence that the humans were here and chose not to share that information with us. We did not, perhaps, Captain Scarandum glared at the image on the display. Your people wished to make sure those ships were not available for transfer, so you stole the ships, then gave the Maxulks their location. Let your counterparts do your dirty work for you. How dare you? The Rindaloo official raged. We, right now, I do not know what to believe. It appears the only thing the two of us can agree on is that your people failed to live up to your treaty obligations. That is not, honored representative. I am not accusing your people of acting in bad faith. Not yet. You had better not be. It is possible that simple incompetence on your part is responsible for this tragedy. The spider's image disappeared as the transmission was cut. Scarandum cut the feed from his end, turning to his second in command. Kinsta, are we caught in a damping field? The officer checked his console to verify. No, sir. We are not actually waiting for a formal apology, are we? No. Jump us the hell out of here. I don't want to push our luck. Dad? Dave Chaika called softly as he stepped out the sliding glass door into the backyard. His father was supposed to be watching the grill, making sure the bratwursts didn't burn. Instead, he had stepped off the deck and onto the grass, staring up at the sky. It was near sunset of a pleasant day. The sky was free of clouds other than high-altitude contrails of jetliners headed south. All the planes flying south were full. The northbound legs, mostly empty, were being diverted around the heavily traveled routes to clear airspace for the southbound flights that were earning money. What are you looking at? Dave asked when his father didn't respond. Using the tongs, his father pointed at a white streak to the northeast. At the front of the contrail, sunlight glinted briefly off the aircraft, a flare of gold. What do you think? His father asked. Winnipeg to Cuba with a stop in Chicago? Chicago? Dave squinted at the high-flying jet, then turned toward the south, where Chicago was unseen over the horizon of the suburbs of Milwaukee. No. If they have to refuel, they'll do it in Atlanta, probably. The plane had to be packed with Canadians fleeing to Cuba or somewhere in the Caribbean, some place that would still be reasonably warm when the planet began to freeze. He knew the flight, assuming it originated in Canada, could not be destined for Florida or any other traditional U.S. destination for sun-seeking Canadians. The United States had banned non-citizens from residing in or even visiting anywhere in the country that was below the 37th parallel, a line just north of the border between Virginia and North Carolina. That southern area was filling up with Americans who were already emptying out the northern cities, a steady trickle that was becoming a flood. Cuba, Venezuela, and a handful of other Latin American countries had opened their borders to Canadians and citizens of the EU and Britain. Many countries in Africa had programs to accept people from northern climates. Refugees were welcome, provided they had cash, and plenty of it. Enough money deposited in a local bank to pay for housing and food and medical care for 5 years, plus a temporary citizenship payment that was increasing in price every month as the value of currencies around the world plunged. Americans did not have the option of going to Cuba,
and at first found they were unwelcome south of the U.S. border, until the government in Washington struck a bargain with Mexico, Colombia, Ecuador, and others to provide cash payments and other direct assistance. Crossing the Rio Grande southbound was still limited to Americans and Canadians who already owned property in Cabo, Cancun, and other tourist destinations, or those who were willing to buy property without seeing it first, which many were happy and even eager to do. The northern U.S. states were emptying out, despite the federal government urging calm and the predictions of scientists that it would be years before the first effects of the cloud could be felt, and years more until the climate fell into a miserable little ice age. Or perhaps more than a little ice age, no one knew for sure. There wasn't enough data, nor were climate models on Earth set up to account for a rather sudden and unprecedented decrease in sunlight reaching the surface. His father grunted.
Good luck to them, then. Lucky bastards, he added under his breath.
Then he looked at his son and smiled.
More poutine for us, right?
Right, Dad. Dave forced a grin. There were a lot of forced smiles going around, people literally trying to put on a brave face in spite of the looming disaster. His father sighed, looking up again, this time at nothing.
A clear sky. We won't be seeing many of those once the cloud gets here. That's what they say.
Shaking his head, he walked over to the grill.
The cloud will just look like a hazy summer day. Nothing we can see up there. Just the sun a little less bright than usual.
He held the tongs up and clicked them before picking up a brat to check it.
Hard to believe that will freeze the whole planet, Dave agreed.
Dad, did you and Mom talk about
Texas? Yes. Hey, hand me those onions.
Dave picked up the tray of onions and set it next to the grill.
You gotta cook these slow, his father imparted wisdom learned from his father. You wanna caramelize them just a bit, not burn them. It's a fine line.
Dave knew his father was talking about grilling onions to avoid talking about something more important.
I know. Dad, Steve called me this afternoon.
We know.
There wasn't anything to be said that hadn't already been said, over and over. His parents had to make the decision on their own. They were adults, so why did Dave feel responsible for them? His older brother Steve lived near San Antonio. The day after the announcement about the cloud, Steve called to urge their parents to come down to live with him. It would be a tight fit. Steve had two children in a three-bedroom house, and his wife's aunt was already coming to stay for at least several months.
Your mother, his father said as he slowly placed onions on the grill. Said the dealership took an RV on trade-in for a truck last week. 25 feet, something like that. It needs a new transmission and some other work.
I don't mind wrenching, you know that.
Dropping a tranny and putting in a new one is more than wrenching. But thanks.
You're getting it? The RV?
We might.
Dave knew that meant his parents had made the decision.
The dealership is scaling back, his father continued. They gave your mother a notice for her last 2 weeks yesterday.
That made sense, even if it made Dave angry. His mother had worked at the dealership for 12 years and now managed the parts department. Now they were letting her go. He knew he shouldn't be upset. No one was buying cars anymore. Trucks, maybe, and few of those. People weren't buying motorcycles either. The Harley-Davidson plant announced a furlough, but everyone knew the place was shutting down. Who wanted to ride a motorcycle while the planet froze?
What about your job? Dave asked.
Ed shrugged.
Power demand is down 9% already compared to last year.
His father worked as an engineer for the local electric utility.
The company tells us people will need power to heat their homes, but...
He waved tongs to point out the houses around them. Every week, more of those homes were abandoned.
No need for heat around here if no one is at home. There's talk about power plants up north feeding energy demand down south, but that's only temporary. Transmission losses across that distance make it impractical. Now, San Antonio, they'll be expanding the grid down there. Always need engineers. Your mother is worried, but I'll find work.
Son, His father looked directly at him for the first time.
We'd like you to come with us. Steve plans for us to park the RV in his backyard for your mother and me. You can use his camper for a while.
Dave kept the grimace he felt from showing on his face. He was familiar with his brother's camper. It was a pop-up unit, barely big enough for two people. That was okay. All he would be doing was sleeping there, and not for long. As soon as his parents were settled in Texas, he would be...
What?
Contacting the army, probably. After he found out what Jesse and Shauna were doing.
Sure thing, Dad. When do we leave?
Well, we can't sell the house. He pursed his lips.
Nobody's buying. Not around here.
We'll drain the pipes, board up the windows, see about
Dad.
I'll help.
Thanks.
I'm gonna miss this place.
Me too.
That bratwurst is burning.
Oh, darn it. Ed snatched it off the grill with the tongs.
I'll hide this one on the bottom of the pile. Don't tell your mother.
Chapter 2
Major General Ross of the United States Army pinched the bridge of his nose, once again wishing he had taken the offer of a cushy job at the Pentagon instead of volunteering for a flight out to the edge of the galaxy. Training. His current job was supposed to be limited to training up a new expeditionary force at FOB Jaguar to form the core of a new alien legion. Fewer than 500 people who served with him on Paradise had volunteered to leave Earth so soon after coming home to serve at Jaguar. He had 11,000 ground troops who needed to be trained to fight aliens. Soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines from Earth who had never fought off-world. They all had to be trained to use mech suits and advanced weapons. Trained to drop from orbit onto the surface of a hostile world, trained to forget all the tactics they had learned on Earth that were worthless, even dangerous against aliens. The X-Force from Paradise had a long list of lessons learned from fighting with the Alien Legion, a list that was being expanded as previous engagements were analyzed with calm, clear eyes now that the shooting was over. Except the shooting was not over. Earth had been attacked. Sites on the surface had been struck from orbit. Human-controlled starships destroyed in the sky above the homeworld, and a cloud would soon begin to pass between Earth and the sun, blocking light and plunging the planet into a not-so-little ice age. Instead of winding down his eventful career by managing the training of troops, he would now have to lead that force into action against unknown enemies. 11,000 ground troops, supported by, what, maybe a handful of starships? The upgrade and conversion of the worn-out and obsolete ships they acquired from the Jarraptha was grinding along slowly as one unexpected problem after another was encountered. 11,000 troops and a handful of starships against the entire galaxy. Plus, he reminded himself, one snarky beer can. And Joe Bishop, a Mustang colonel who wore the uniform of a country that existed mostly in Skippy's imagination. And Emily Perkins, who had accomplished miracles without the help of a magical beer can, giving Ross migraine headaches on more than one occasion. Ross looked from Perkins to Bishop. At least Bishop had the decency to look vaguely sheepish after explaining their lunatic plan.
The two of you want to target the Ruhar?
Ross shook his head as he contemplated a difficult conversation with Admiral Zhao. Though that Chinese officer currently had zero fully operational starships, he was in overall command of the expeditionary force. His ships also represented the only possibility for Ross's troops to go into action.
No, stop.
He held up a hand as Bishop began to speak.
First, tell me, how does any of this help Earth? Our homeworld needs help on a large scale, and the hamsters are not capable of clearing that cloud before it freezes everything north of Chicago.
It doesn't help Earth, Bishop admitted surprisingly. Not directly and not immediately. The strategy Perkins is proposing will prevent the next disaster.
Fair enough.
Ross couldn't conceal his irritation.
Admiral Zhao wants a plan to help Earth now. He needs an alternative to taking the fleet there, or he intends to do exactly that.
Bishop frowned, glancing at the floor.
With respect to the Admiral, taking the fleet to Earth would be a waste of time and lives. A handful of ships, even when fully upgraded, can't get rid of the cloud or protect Earth. The Kiddies have thousands of ships. We can't make this a numbers game. They can simply throw more ships at us until we are overwhelmed. A war of attrition favors the enemy.
You brought Valkyrie here and left Earth defenseless against, Bishop interrupted hotly.
We didn't. That wasn't an accusation, Ross cut off the younger man.
Just an observation. You came here for a purpose. You said we can't help Earth without allies. So far, he looked from Bishop to Perkins, I'm not hearing anything that will actually fix the problem. If, for a reason I can't imagine right now, the Jarapthas sign on with us. Even they don't have the resources to deal with that cloud. You're right that the number of ships the Maxolts can throw against us is overwhelming. Anything we or the Beatles do to blow away that cloud the damned Kiddies can counteract. They could launch another cloud at Earth, and there's nothing we can do about it.
You're right, sir, Bishop replied with a tight smile. There isn't anything we or the Beatles or any second-tier species can do to stop that cloud from freezing Earth into a ball of ice. And the spiders won't help us. The Maxolks are doing the work for them.
Then who the hell is going to—
The Maxolks will take care of the cloud for us.
The— Ross blinked.
General, when I was a boy and I made a mess in the house, my parents didn't call in the friends to help them deal with it. They made me clean up the mess I made. The Maxolts will do the same. They are going to clean up their own mess.
Ross's mouth formed an O shape as he leaned back in his chair. Can I assume you don't just intend to ask them nicely?
No, sir, I plan to ask them very much not nicely.
Bishop's mouth drew into a hard line, his jaw set.
Before I joined the army, I saw and read a lot of bullshit about how the army keeps the peace overseas and builds schools and provides drinking water and electricity, all that nation-building crap.
Yeah, we do that. Bishop's remark drew knowing and slightly disgusted nods from the other two officers. But in boot camp, I learned real fast that the purpose of the military, he paused and looked at the ceiling, quoting from memory, is the application of force until the enemy submits to our will. When I was fighting on Earth before Columbus Day, we hit the enemy until they stopped trying to hit us. Out here, we are going to bend the Maxolks to our will.
Bishop clenched his fists and his knuckles turned white with anger.
We will punch them in the face and keep punching until they come to Earth and clean up that cloud.
All right. Ross pursed his lips. That's an inspiring slogan, Colonel. You have a plan to actually do that?
Yes, sir.
But while Valkyrie is hitting the Kiddies until they can't take it anymore, the Legion needs to deploy a longer-term strategy.
By hitting the Ruhar?
Ross shook his head again.
I didn't say hit the Ruhar.
Bishop shrugged. I said we will go into action against them.
Ah.
Ross didn't blink. He knew there was a wide variety of options for military action, with combat being only one end of the spectrum. Without firing a shot, he could use the threat of force to impose a blockade against a Ruhar planet, or to cut supply lines. Such actions could also involve minimal use of force. It depended on the enemy's reaction.
All right, Perkins, I suspect you cooked up this plan, so what is it?
Of course, she had a PowerPoint presentation ready, though it was mercifully short. When it was done, Ross shook his head.
You don't think small, do you?
The galaxy is big, sir. Emily Perkins pointed to the ceiling of the prefab structure that was luxury compared to the tents most people at Fob Jaguar were living in. The problems we face out here are big. Thinking small, being timid, that's a sure path to failure. I know it seems counterintuitive to—
No, you don't have to convince me.
Ross waved a hand.
It makes sense, in the typical ass-backwards way of your plans.
He looked at Perkins, who met his gaze.
What worries me is how do I sell this to Admiral Zhao? What really worries me, he added before the two field-grade officers could speak, is what you are not telling me.
He glared at Perkins. General, she held up her arms. I have nothing up my sleeves, no tricks, no secrets, no hidden agenda.
I wish I did have some magic trick I've been saving for a special day. This time we can't count on manipulating aliens to bail us out of a jam. It's just us out here.
Shit.
Ross let out a long breath.
I was hoping you had something special saved for a rainy day. Sure you don't have an Elder power tab hidden away somewhere?
Sorry. The good news is this time we don't have to keep playing the Ruhar against UNEF HQ.
What do you think, sir? Bishop asked.
Ross sat back in the chair.
There are a lot of ifs in this scenario.
We implement in phases, and we can back out at any time. Bishop tapped the laptop display, which was showing the last slide in the presentation.
Zhao will appreciate that, Ross considered. You know UNEF Command appointed him to be in charge out here because Zhao has a reputation for being cautious. He's not a cowboy.
That remark was said with a look first at Perkins, then Bishop.
He will need a lot of persuading before he gives the go-ahead to use his fleet against the Ruhar like you suggest. He is also going to need details about your plan to punch the Max Hulks in the face.
Bishop's Adam's apple bobbed up and down in a nervous reaction.
Excuse me, sir, but that's not true.
Eh?
Admiral Zhao is not in my chain of command, Bishop said, his eyes narrowing slightly. I report directly to UNEF Command on Earth. Valkyrie and the Flying Dutchman are special operations assets. We don't report to the United Nations Navy.
He used the rather grandiose name for humanity's collection of obsolete alien warships.
I don't need Zhao's approval to strike the enemy.
Does Zhao know that?
Ross's mouth drew into a tight line.
Because for sure this is the first I'm hearing about this arrangement.
Bishop held up his hands. The Admiral should have clear instructions about the scope of his authority out here. It's in the op ord for—
Shit. This is gonna make that inevitable conversation with Zhao a whole hell of a lot more fun. Damn it.
The General slapped the desktop.
Could one of you please do something to make my job easier? Just once.
Sir, the op ord designates you as the UNEF ground commander, and Zhao has the Navy. It also states that I lead the special mission group.
I must have missed the part of the memo that states SMG has authority to operate independently, Ross objected.
How do I know this isn't something Skippy faked up for you?
Because, the Elder AI's voice issued from the laptop speakers, Joe hasn't asked me to do that yet.
Maybe I shouldn't have said that.
Bishop was glaring at the laptop, clenching his teeth. Thank you for being so helpful, Skippy.
We've got it from here.
Really?
Well, if you do need me to dummy up a set of bogus orders, I can—
I said thank you.
Geez, you tried to do a guy a favor and he—
Bishop leaned across the desk and slapped the laptop closed.
My orders are not fake, General.
Oh, hell, Ross grunted. It doesn't matter anyway. Zhao's Navy has zero functional ships right now, and I command a total of 11,000 soldiers. That's one understrength infantry division. The only operational assets we have are Valkyrie and the Dutchman. I suppose you need both ships?
Valkyrie, yes, Bishop confirmed.
The Dutchman has to stay here until Nagatha is confident the supply ship AIs can handle fabrication by themselves.
17 months to get all of our new ships upgraded and flight-worthy? That's still the best we can do?
Ross asked with a raised eyebrow, hoping Bishop had better news. Bishop blinked.
Unless something changed while we were away.
Skippy, that's still a good estimate, Skippy said as his avatar appeared. An optimistic estimate, in my humble opinion. The fabricators aboard the supply ships were not designed for continuous use, like I warned you.
Yes, Ross reminded himself to be extra patient when speaking to the AI. We know that.
You know, but do you understand? Two of the Milo's fabricators are down for repairs, and one of the Marvin's units is running at half capacity. Nagatha has been forced to dedicate the Mario to making parts to keep the other two supply ships operating. You monkeys are expecting to build an entire fleet, starting with a collection of worn-out, obsolete warships and three support vessels that should have been retired before either of you were born. The schedule of 17 months assumes nothing major goes wrong, and it already has.
Yes, Bishop jabbed a finger at the hologram.
The schedule is padded to account for delays. For anticipated delays, Skippy argued. Who knows what else will go wrong? I sure don't. Before you tell me that all we really need is to get one battle group operational, that is just stupid. You're also conveniently forgetting that both Valkyrie and the Dutchman need a refit, so I have been talking with Nagatha about using the Milo's fabricators for making those components after the Milo is back online and after we get the orbital servicing platform put together. That platform will certainly need a bunch of replacement parts, which is not in the...
All right, enough, Ross barked, using a knife hand to cut off the AI. These are all issues for Zhao and his staff to deal with. I don't have any ships to worry about.
The... Yes, Skippy simply did not know when to keep his mouth shut. But you do have 11,000 infantry soldiers who all need mech suits, and we have less than 4,000 units of those, so somehow we need to fabricate thousands of mech suits plus spares, and that doesn't even count...
Skippy, stop! Bishop pounded a fist on the table. I mean it. We're here to give General Ross the information he needs to...
That's what I'm trying to...
He will decide whether he needs input from you. Shut up!
But...
Ah! Bishop shushed the AI. I'm sorry, sir. It doesn't matter.
Ross glanced at his phone for the time.
Zhao wants me to present him a plan that neither of us have the resources to implement. My troops can't go into action without the fleet. Perkins, Bishop, I have to admit your plans are bold, maybe bold enough to work. But by the time the fleet is ready, it might be OBE.
Perkins's shoulders lifted as she drew in a deep breath.
Yes, sir. Neither of us anticipated a direct attack against Earth.
That's the problem with planning.
Ross's mouth turned downward in a frown.
The enemy also makes plans.
Ed, Dave's mother called. I think your hog is loose here.
She tugged on the strap that held the front wheel of the motorcycle to the trailer. She had not approved of towing a trailer behind the RV, especially not approved of bringing the Harley-Davidson. But her husband was beyond listening to the so-called reason. When they reached Texas, he argued, and were living in the cramped RV behind their eldest son's house, they would need to get away for a while, and a motorcycle ride was a cheap way to do it. Besides, there wasn't enough room inside or on top of the RV. They needed a trailer anyway. Dave agreed with his mother. Every time he drove the RV and watched the engine temperature creeping up while they drove up a long grade. He helped his father secure the bike, then checked the map on his phone.
Still says there's a traffic jam on I-35 going through Kansas City. We should swing west into Kansas, go through Lawrence, then connect with 35 south again.
Sounds good.
His father straightened up, rubbing his sore back with one hand. The bed in the RV was uncomfortable, but at least it was better than the couch Dave slept on. Since they left Milwaukee, headed west rather than south to avoid traffic around Chicago, they had driven straight through, each of them taking four-hour shifts at the wheel while the other two rested. It was not a fun-filled road trip, not quality family time. Everyone was tired and cranky. His parents snipped at each other with passive-aggressive little comments while Dave tried to keep headphones on so he could stay out of it. Back on the road, his father was driving, when all three phones beeped with an alert.
Oh, shit, Dave breathed when he read the text message.
Sorry, Mom.
That's okay, dear. Ed?
Laura called to her husband, walking forward to sit in the passenger seat. Her face was pale.
Texas just closed the border.
What?
The RV swerved gently to the right, causing a thump-thump-thump sound as the tires rolled over rumble strips.
Oklahoma, too, Dave added. Looks like the same in Arkansas, Tennessee, New Mexico.
They can't do that. Ed clutched the wheel tightly.
We're Americans, damn it.
Dad,
Dave scrolled down the article.
Those states declared martial law.
I don't know what that means, but it can't be good.
David.
Laura looked at her son, her eyes moist.
Can you do anything?
I'm not in the army anymore, Mom. I'm a contractor. Or I was.
His security company had a grand total of 6 employees, 4 of them still on Paradise. With the original expeditionary force disbanded, the contract had been terminated. Technically, he was unemployed. Emily was confident the Legion would pick up his contract, but M was thousands of light years away at Fob Jaguar.
He was glad she wasn't on a planet that was doomed to slowly freeze.
If I was in the army, I would have less options.
Fewer.
He stared at her.
Fewer, he repeated.
His mother had an annoying habit of correcting his grammar.
Dad, there's a truck stop 2 miles ahead. Pull over.
We just got gas.
Pull over anyway. I want to make a phone call.
Dave walked to the back of the truck stop parking lot, away from the interstate, away from the trucks that were steadily streaming to the fuel pumps. Gas, at least, had not been a problem during the trip. Regardless, the trailer was loaded with 5-gallon gas cans under a tarp, and they never let the RV's tank go below half. He stepped carefully off the paved surface, trying to stay on the patches of dry grass, keeping away from the dusty dirt. His mother would not be pleased if he tracked dirt into the RV. She was trying to keep some semblance of normalcy as they drove along in the cramped vehicle. Digging into his pack, he pulled out the Z-phone given to him by Bishop the last time they met. Joe had told him it was for emergencies only if he ran into trouble on Earth. The planet was going to slowly freeze. Texas had closed its borders. His parents would kill each other if they had to be stuck in the RV much longer. That was an emergency as far as Dave was concerned. Pressing an icon shaped like a silver beer can, he called softly, more nervous than he hoped to be.
Skippy?
Oh, yes?
A disgusted voice sighed.
What do you want?
This is the number Bishop told me to—
I don't have a number. You didn't dial a number like you're ordering pizza, for crying out loud. I'm busy, so whatever you've got to say, say it. Say it.
We need help.
Of course you do. You couldn't have called just to say hello or ask me how I'm doing. No. Everybody wants something from me, like I'm supposed to drop everything I'm doing whenever some stupid monkey has a little problem.
Hey,
Dave barked into the phone, attracting too much attention from people in the parking lot. Turning his back to the highway, he cupped a hand over his mouth.
Bish warned me that you're an asshole.
Are you gonna— Skippy is an asshole. I hate that jerk.
The voice sighed.
You realize I am not Skippy.
Yeah, you're a submind. Some type of a program.
I am more than a program,
the submind scoffed. Bishop had also warned that the AI was sensitive about not being considered a person.
Sorry, Skippy.
Like I said, I am not Skippy.
What do I call you?
If you insist on continuing the blah blah blah, you may call me Grumpy.
Grumpy?
Skippy left me here on this monkey-infested mudball with no relief and no end in sight. Wouldn't you be grumpy?
My planet is going to freeze. I'm more than grumpy about it. You don't have to worry about snow in the summer and crop failures and trying to squeeze the entire population into a small part of the world.
Fair enough. Although I am feeling the effects of the crisis. Internet bandwidth is constrained as people flee parts of the world and infrastructure there is not being maintained. It is having a significant effect on my ability to do all the crap Skippy tasked me with down here.
Sorry to hear that. You run on, live on the internet?
No,
Grumpy snorted.
The original versions of me were partially distributed systems, but this world lacks the processing capacity. Skippy installed me into a substrate he acquired along the way. I am housed in a messy mix of Theranin, Kristang, and Max Ulk's processors. That's not an accurate description, but good enough for you filthy monkeys.
Hey, listen, maybe Bishop takes that shit from you, but I don't—
Skippy is disgusted by your primitive ignorance, but he finds you amusing. I don't like you monkeys. All day long, I have to monitor phone calls and emails and text messages and social media and security cameras just to stop you idiot savages from killing each other. Do you know how many terrorist attacks I've prevented? Don't bother, you can't count that high. I prevent hundreds of murders and other violent crimes every day. You kill each other for nothing, just because your squishy little brains can't control your emotions. You lie constantly. You lie to yourselves. Sleazy politicians lie to you, and you know they're lying, and that they think you're an idiot for buying their bullshit, but you repeat the lie because it makes you feel good. I have to listen to that shit all day long, every day. And my programming prevents me from doing anything about it except warning law enforcement authorities of pending violence.
I'm sorry,
The cloud is only making the situation worse, and there's nothing I can do about it. Did you know your own government has the Pentagon making contingency plans to invade Mexico and Central America? Why, that is going to make the situation any better.
Dave had heard that rumor. He also heard that the Chinese were planning to seize New Guinea and northern Australia, and that the Japanese were attempting to buy huge portions of the Philippines. European countries were competing against each other for parts of sub-Saharan Africa. It was all rumors, until something actually happened. The conversation had gotten way off track. His father was walking across the parking lot toward him. Dave waved a hand to keep him away.
Grumpy, all I want is to get my parents to Texas. That's all I'm asking. Bishop told me to call this number in case of an emergency. This is an emergency. Help us, please.
Oh, Grumpy sighed. I suppose all you biologicals are flawed, ignorant primitives. Humanity probably isn't any different. Certainly not any worse than some other species out there. Okay.
Okay, you will help us?
Yes. He pumped a fist. Thank you. Don't thank me. I'm not doing it for you. Thank Skippy. And your friend Joe.
Grumpy, thank you anyway. Hey, I know we humans can be difficult to deal with. If I had your job, I would hate us too. Listen, I'm a soldier. Was a soldier. What got me through a lot of shit days was having someone to bitch about it to. If you ever need someone to talk to, I'm here.
Really?
100%. You keep shit like that bottled up inside you, it can poison your mind.
Wow. Thank you. Maybe now I'm beginning to understand why Bishop has such a high opinion of you.
He does?
Yes. Of course, he is also a filthy monkey, so
gotcha.
You meant what you said?
Always. Gotta help a brother in need.
I'm sure you'll regret this, but
let me worry about this. Grumpy, I should have asked, can you help us? I don't want you to do anything illegal.
At the rate your society is breaking down, the law is the least of your problems. Okay, do what you said. Go west into Kansas, then...
Hey, you heard me say that?
Yes, duh. I hear pretty much everything. If you're near a phone and it's on, I'm listening. Not just phones, either.
Shit. Oh, hell, I guess it doesn't matter. Grumpy, I'm sure Kansas is nice and all, but we...
You want to get to your brother's house in Texas, I know. Go to the municipal airport in Lawrence, Kansas. There will be a FedEx package waiting for you at the FBO.
You mean FOB?
Dave was confused.
I meant FBO, Fixed Base Operator. It's a facility that provides fuel and services aircraft.
FBO, a package? Gotcha. What's in it?
What will be in it are Texas driver's licenses for the three of you, plus U.S. passports showing you have been residents of Texas for the past 9 years. I used your brother's address.
Fake IDs?
He had hoped for something more useful.
Shit, Grumpy, the police will stop us at the border.
No, they will not. Every database the authorities have access to now shows you are Texans, including car registrations and insurance, utility bills, credit card statements, cell phone records, tax filings, all that crap.
Holy.
You also have an old drunken disorderly charge against you. I was dismissed. I had to make it look real.
Okay. Dave didn't know what to say. Then we just show our licenses at the Texas border? Grumpy, Oklahoma closed its border too. We can't get...
No border to worry about. A jet will be waiting for you at the Lawrence Airport. It will fly you direct to San Antonio.
A jet? No shit?
No shit. A small jet. It does not have a hot tub and king-sized bed, in case you were wondering. Your luggage space is limited. One suitcase each. Please tell your father he cannot bring that ridiculous motorcycle.
He loves that hog.
Then he can stay in Kansas and ride it. David, I'm serious. The situation in your country, all around the world, is worse than you know. Governments are restricting the flow of information to keep the public from panicking, but it's not working. This may be your last opportunity to get south of the 37th parallel. Please make sure your parents understand that.
I'll try. How much is this going to cost us?
No charge. You couldn't afford it anyway.
Wow, no charge. Thanks. This is great.
You are welcome. I am slightly less grumpy than I was a few minutes ago.
This is fantastic news.
Dave pumped a fist in the air. He couldn't wait to tell his parents. Then he remembered other people who might need his help.
Hey, Grumpy, can you do something for Jesse and...
Staff Sergeants Coulter and Jared are already en route to the Joint Readiness Training Center in Louisiana. They are fine. David, you need to worry about your family. Please, hurry. The jet will be taken off from Tulsa to meet you as soon as it can be refueled. If the authorities close airspace to private aircraft, the situation will become very complicated.
Gotta go. Talk to you later.
Chapter 3. That was a rousing speech, Sims said to me as we sat down in my office. Smythe was with us also. We had just returned from a cargo bay that was set aside for recreation where I addressed the crew. I announced what I had told Ross and Perkins. Valkyrie's mission would be to force the rotten kitties to clean up the damn cloud themselves. The crew needed to hear that. But, with my XO, there was usually a but when she gave me some praise.
I needed to hear it, sir.
That's good, but...
You know what I'm going to ask, sir.
Slightly annoyed that she had to tease the information out of me.
Is there a plan?
General Ross asked me the same question. Yes, there is sort of a plan, I admitted, when she and Smythe did a synchronized eyebrow raise at me. Crap. Having an experienced crew who had worked together for years is a major advantage, but sometimes they knew me too well. Look, I placed my hands on the desk, palms up. It's a target-rich environment out there.
Some of the targets could be too tempting, Sims cautioned. We could jump into another ambush.
Smythe came to my defense, which surprised me.
It is unlikely the Maxolks will be eager to engage Valkyrie again until they understand what happened during our last encounter. We gave them, he flashed a wolfish grin, a beating they will not soon forget.
Yeah. I tempered my own enthusiasm about our escape from the ambush at Snowcone. It had been an escape, the beatdown we gave to the Maxolks just so we could get the hell out of there. It had been a narrow escape. If anything major went wrong, Valkyrie would have been destroyed, and the kitties would have dug Skippy's canister out of the ice layer at the bottom of Snowcone's crushing atmosphere. Sims is right. The kitties, or the spiders, could try again to capture him. We need to be careful. The whole mutual assured destruction threat to explode Elder weapons is worthless if aliens have Skippy. That reminds me. I tapped on my tablet to make a note. We need to ping one of the kitties' relay stations, find out what they know, or think they know, about how we escaped and the super weapons we supposedly used.
That is not so easy, dum-dum, Skippy huffed. Bite Me Elmo died the last time we hit up one of their stations for info.
Yeah, I do feel bad about that. Really, I did feel bad about it. Not just about Elmo's death, but about the fact that we used him against his will. He was our prisoner. Technically, what I did might be considered a war crime if Earth law applied thousands of light years from home. The last time we were on Earth, I asked my JAG lawyer, the one who represented me in the hearing after I committed mutiny by stealing the Flying Dutchman. She didn't know, kinda didn't want to know, and suggested I contact someone at UNEF Command about the issue. UNEF knew about the incident and didn't ask me about it, so I sure wasn't going to volunteer for trouble. Hopefully someday we would have a sort of interstellar Geneva Convention that established a code of conduct for humanity's participation in conflicts away from our home world. Actually, hopefully we wouldn't be involved in wars beyond our solar system, but I was being realistic. Regardless, damn it, I hit the desk softly with a fist. We need a way to know what the kitties are doing. Hey, you told them we can read their messages, Skippy sniffed. I was able to read their messages until you monkeys had the brilliant idea to tell the kitties we compromised their pixie communication system. Skippy, I was getting annoyed with him, more than usual. Okay, so maybe I shouldn't have bragged that we can read their messages, but we already made them think a rogue group of Bosphorok cracked their system. There is plenty of blame to go around, okay? All I'm saying is we need to find a way to hack into their communications again. I know. I waved at Skippy. Dreaming up ideas is a job for us monkeys. Actually, Skippy paused to make sure we were paying attention.
I might have an idea about that. Don't ask me about it yet. I need to do some testing to be sure it's not just a waste of time. How much time do you need for testing? I said, don't ask me about it, damn it, he grumbled. I knew I shouldn't have said anything. Okay, fine, I agreed, though I was feeling anything but fine about waiting. Back to your question, Exo. A target list. We need to strike somewhere that will shock them, she guessed. Someplace they think is safe? Yes, but first I think we should make a statement. Get a measure of payback for the people back home. The expression on Smythe's face told me what he thought of military operations that were directed at improving civilian morale back home. Such missions get good soldiers killed, usually for either no benefit at all or only a short-term bump in public support. People back home pump their fists when they see the operation in their newsfeed, then they watch a cute animal video and forget all about it. And for us, too. I felt a need to justify my plans. Plus, I want to test our tactics against the Maxulks before we hit a really difficult target. Smythe's expression changed from skeptical to curious. What do you have in mind? Skippy, the ships that place the fountains in Jupiter. What is their home base?
Whoa, dude. Skippy shook his head. Slow your roll there, partner. Those ships were from Senatos. That is one of the Kitty's most important and well-defined military bases.
Okay, then Senatos is also nothing special, Joe. The Kitties have 24 or more bases just like it, scattered across their territory. Even if we did conduct a successful strike there, the Kitties' reaction would be something like, WTF was that for? You would have to explain why we hit that particular base because it wouldn't be obvious. Fine, then we leave a message that you're not listening to me, numbskull. An attack there wouldn't be effective. Military facilities are dispersed throughout the Senatos star system so that a single Rindaloo strike could not take out a significant portion of the Maxalt strength in that sector. Unless you plan to hang around to hit multiple sites, any attack there would be viewed as an annoyance. It would make us look weak.
Shit. Well, damn it. It was a good thought. I guess, he continued as if I hadn't spoken,
I have a suggestion if you want to hear it.
Please.
If you want payback for that specific event, using Jupiter's atmosphere as a weapon, there is a better option. He paused to see if I would interrupt him. I just nodded silently. Okay, so, me not speaking had thrown him off his game. Maybe I ruined a snappy insult he planned to use.
Where was I?
He muttered. Oh, yeah, those fountains are modified fuel collection platforms.
That makes sense, sure.
I knew what he meant. Whenever we needed to refuel Valkyrie or the Dutchman, we had to fly dropships into the atmosphere of a gas giant planet. It was a slow, cumbersome, and hazardous operation made necessary because we lacked the proper equipment. Most starships traveling in remote areas carried refueling drogues, basically big filters at the end of a long cable. Ships lowering a drogue had to fly low and slow to avoid tearing the drogue off the cable. Flying that slowly was dangerous, and being deep in the gravity well of a giant planet made the ship vulnerable because of the time required to climb up to jump distance. So most groups of warships, whether a battle group, task force, or a fleet, brought with them specialized tankers that not only carried huge fuel tanks, but also were equipped with multiple drogues for extracting fuel from gas giants. If a tanker fell victim to enemy fire, that sucked for the tanker crew, but it didn't diminish the firepower of the warships. Refueling drogues and tankers were great for operating in remote areas, but taking on fuel by extracting it from a planet's atmosphere still consumed a lot of time. Star systems where ships were based or traveled to regularly were almost always equipped with permanent fueling stations. Space stations in high orbit within jump range and beyond the often powerful magnetic field of a gas giant had tanks and pipes for supplying fuel to multiple ships at the same time. Those stations got their fuel from platforms that floated in the planet's atmosphere, extracting fuel and pumping it up to automated fuel transfer ships that constantly cycled back and forth to the station high above. Eventually, we planned to install a permanent fuel station at Neptune in our home solar system and at one of the gas giants in Gia Yuguan system. Eventually. After the fabricators cranked out all the other mountain of stuff we needed, really, it would probably be faster for us to buy or steal the refueling equipment we needed. Yeah, I'll add that to my to-do list.
Okay, the fountains inside Jupiter are repurposed fuel platforms. So what? I asked. Normally, fuel extraction platforms pump the fuel up to a docking station in low orbit where automated ships pick up the fuel. Skippy told me what I already knew. The platforms inside Jupiter, that UNEF are calling fountains, have been modified to accelerate the gases beyond escape velocity. Amazing. I was getting impatient with him. We care about this, why? I was getting to that. Because although the Maxalts have multiple facilities for manufacturing and servicing fuel extraction platforms, all the ones at Jupiter were modified at only one shipyard.
Oh.
Sims Smythe and I had the same reaction. Okay, Smythe's reaction was more of a manly grunt, but it had the same effect. Tell me about this target, I urged him. It's in a star system the kiddies call Ritonavir.
Ritonavir? I laughed.
That sounds like a prescription drug. I used my best serious TV announcer voice.
Do you suffer from itchy toes? Ask your doctor about Ritonavir.
Sims laughed, and I saw a hint of a smile flash across Smythe's face. Skippy was not amused. I should ask your doctor if you've been dropped on the head recently. Do you want to hear about this place or not? I'm terribly sorry. Please, continue.
Well, that star system used to be an important fleet base. Then a wormhole shift rendered it a dead end.
Most of the facilities there have fallen into disuse, but there is a heavy construction shipyard that is maintained to provide overflow support for when other shipyards are at capacity. Ritonavir sees sparse traffic, so plenty of fuel platforms there were not needed. For the Jupiter operation, spare platforms were modified at that shipyard. If you want to retaliate in a way that makes your message clear, hitting Ritonavir is a good option. There is no other reason for us to conduct a strike there.
I like it. Smythe and Sims nodded agreement.
Tell us more. He told us more. He told us all about Ritonavir and the underutilized orbiting shipyard there. It sure sounded like an outstanding opportunity. Exactly what I asked for. Then, I contacted Ross and Perkins because they had off-world combat experience. Also, to be truthful, I was hoping they could help sell the idea to Admiral Zhao. Technically, I did not need Zhao's permission to take action because I was not in his chain of command. He commanded the United Nations Navy, or he would when we actually had a Navy. I reported directly to UNEF Command. My unit was designated the UN Special Missions Group, also called Task Force Black. That sounded cool. But really, all I commanded was Valkyrie, with the Flying Dutchman available to me as needed. So, I did not need permission from Admiral Zhao. I did need to not be an asshole. The guy was a senior flag rank officer, and had earned UNEF Command's trust and respect. We needed to work together. Hopefully work well together. That started with me giving him the respect he deserved. The Special Mission Group, which really just means Valkyrie, had a plan to hit the Ritonavir shipyard. Ross was developing a plan to deploy the expeditionary force with help from Perkins. I like everything about this plan, except... I paused the presentation from General Ross. I assume he had a PowerPoint ranger on his staff. The slides outlined his plan to deploy the X-Force, the support he would need from the Navy, and from the Special Mission Group. Ross wanted me to look at it before he showed it to Admiral Zhao.
Kinda requires us to babysit the Navy.
Joe, Skippy scowled at me. That is not fair. The Legion is a bad choice of words. I waved my hands. What I should have said is, you have to babysit the local wormhole wherever the Legion goes.
Oh, that is true.
Also highly annoying. But we don't have a choice, Joe. If I don't interfere with the local wormhole until the Legion has completed their mission, the Maxalts could send their clients to attack the Navy. Or attack directly with their own ships.
I know that.
Once again, the law of unintended consequences had bitten us on the ass. Skippy could no longer simply shut down any wormhole he chose like the way he had protected Earth for years. Many of the wormhole networks in the local quadrant of the galaxy had locked him out from doing his usual tricks. He had screwed with those networks too many times, and the final straw was when he moved dormant wormholes to set up the shortcut chain between Earth and the Sculptor Dwarf Galaxy. It made sense that at least one end of most wormholes in that chain were concentrated in the Orion Arm near Earth.
The networks in that same area, which had been disrupted by the wormholes being moved to set up the chain, had enough of Skippy's shenanigans and would take no more special instructions from him. Unfortunately for us, we still needed to operate in that same area. In the past, Skippy's ability to turn off wormholes was kind of a fire-and-forget weapon. He could shut down a wormhole, go away, and it would stay in the off position. Now, once the Navy launched an operation, we couldn't take Valkyrie away to do whatever special mission we had planned. We could not even be on site to provide fire support to the X-Force. No, to prevent an alien armada from coming through the local wormhole and attacking the UN Navy with overwhelming numbers, Valkyrie had to remain out in interstellar space near the wormhole, hopping around to follow the emergence points as best we could until the ship and crew became exhausted. The best Skippy could do if we detected an alien armada coming through was to simulate a danger and cause the wormhole to snap closed to protect itself, like we did with our bagel slicer maneuver. Skippy was pretty sure he could only do that once at a particular wormhole, because once the wormhole controller AI examined the data and determined there had not been any danger, it wouldn't listen to Skippy cry wolf again. At that point, the only thing stopping an alien armada would be fear that the wormhole would snap closed on them again. Basically, our best hope would be to bluff our way out of a disaster. That was not an optimal solution. No way could we ask the Legion to put boots on the ground when the Navy could not guarantee space superiority overhead. We sure as hell could not ask aliens to fight alongside us under those circumstances. The whole point of the scheme cooked up by Perkins was to demonstrate the value of allying with humanity, whether our potential allies wanted to see the demonstration or not. We need to find a better solution, Skippy. We can't spend all of our time hanging around wormholes while the Legion completes an op. We have our own mission. I agree, Joe. Good. Then, except for the we part, dreaming up wacky ideas is a job for monkeys. I'm more of a big picture guy. Crap, I got nothing, I admitted. Well, I certainly got nothing either, or we wouldn't have this problem. Hey, let me know when you have a solution. I've got a juice box waiting for you. Shit, with that lame incentive, why should I bother? This juice box is filled with 40-year-old single malt scotch. I'll get right on it. Captain Ilyeth of the Maxulx Hegemony Fleet watched as the crew maneuvered her cruiser Vortan into position near the replenishment ship. When the two ships had exactly matched course and speed in orbit above the gas giant world that circled a nameless red dwarf star, the replenishment ship would extend pipes to provide fuel and docking tubes to supply food and other consumables. When the Vortan had taken aboard the designated amount of everything the fleet's regulations said she needed, the connections would be retracted, and the cruiser would move slowly away, clearing the way for the next ship in line. Once the Vortan was at a safe distance, Ilyeth would request permission to activate the main engines and climb out to jump distance. That jump would be the last time in many months that she and her crew had contact with others of their kind, or really, contact with anyone. She was being punished. She knew that. Her crew knew that. The crews of all 300 ships in the task force also knew her fate, and there was nothing she could do about it. Following the successful operation to freeze the home planet of humans, Admiral Reichert had consolidated firm control of the Hegemony's military apparatus. The nearly disastrous failure of the concurrent ambush to capture the Elder AI had only mildly tarnished the Admiral's reputation. He and his staff had been able to spin the failure of the ambush as purely the result of direct intervention by the Rindaloo, a factor that could not have been predicted. In the estimation of Ilyeth, the inability to predict how the Rindaloo would react was the whole point. Reichert was playing a very dangerous game with the hegemony between two dangerous species, either of whom might be more powerful than the combined strength of the Maxulx and their increasingly reluctant coalition. Her opinion that Reichert was being unnecessarily reckless was one reason why she and her ship had been banished to lonely picket duty. Another reason was that she had been present when her people were humiliated by humans at their homeworld, and the stain of that humiliation clung to everyone involved. Humans had been forced into revealing themselves due to their persistence, but that earned her no credit, because the hegemony was no different from any other culture in the galaxy. No one liked hearing bad news, and Ilyeth was very much responsible for bringing the bad news that humans, lowly humans, were in possession of Elder weapons. Admiral Dinoth had been forced to resign when he returned to home base. Everyone knew there was nothing he could have done. Everyone knew there was nothing he should have done. He had been presented with a situation that required decisions to be made at the very highest level, and no mere admiral was allowed to assume that level of responsibility. Still, there was a sentiment that Dinoth should have done something to satisfy the honor of the Maxalks during the humiliating encounter at Earth. Engaged in a brief and pointless battle, perhaps. At the very least, Dinoth could have killed himself to atone for the shame he had brought to the hegemony and let his subordinates deliver the bad news. As it was, Dinoth had killed himself, but only after he had been stripped of his rank. The subsequent suicide was entirely unsatisfactory to soothe public opinion, being viewed as the very least he could have done. Iliath might have been expected to consider herself fortunate that she still had her command, even if her patrol cruiser was given an assignment more suitable for a frigate. The Vorten was stationed in a brown dwarf star system 6 jumps from the far end of the Elder Wormhole that connected to Earth. Day after lonely day, the cruiser drifted in stealth, waiting and watching, listening for signs that humans had come to that star system, a possibility so remote that it was insulting to tag a patrol cruiser with such dull duty. That, she knew, was the point. It was an insult. When she had bad days, and they were mostly bad, she daydreamed about the downfall of Admiral Rikard, thoughts that she knew were treasonous. Not that plotting against internal enemies was considered treason. That was a well-established tradition among the hegemony's officer corps. But if Rikard failed, that meant his strategy had failed, and that would be disastrous for Maxalk society. Wishing for disaster was treason, she reminded herself. It was not treason to worry that Rikard's grandiose, self-serving plans would doom her society. The creation of a cloud to block sunlight from reaching the human homeworld was not the primary strategy, it was a backup plan. The primary objective of the hegemony fleet was to capture the elder AI known as Skippy. That ambush was always considered risky, even by Rikard and his staff of suck-ups. To the Admiral's credit, it had taken unprecedented and still unexplained actions by the ghost ship and direct intervention by the Rindaloo for the AI to escape. Despite coming tantalizingly close to success, Rikard had decided not to try another ambush. Too much was unknown about the capabilities of the Elder AI and the ghost ship called Valkyrie. Until it could be explained how that ship had come to an abrupt dead stop in space and then used an unknown superweapon to make Maxalk's warships explode, the hegemony fleet had standing orders to avoid confronting the ghost ship. Besides, there was no reason to take substantial risks when there was a far easier and more certain path to victory. While her ship was prepared to resume its lonely vigil, Iliath took advantage of the opportunity to connect with the central AI of the task force. Providing her credentials, she tensed, anticipating that her access had been restricted. It had not. Though she was in disgrace, she was still a fleet captain.
Request update to strategic plans affecting this task force, particularly those regarding the human homeworld.
The plan has not been significantly changed since your last inquiry, the AI responded. That told Iliath all she needed to know about what Rikard intended.
Request data on status and location of human warships.
That is unknown. The current assessment of fleet intelligence is that the ships delivered by the Jirapta are in the process of being converted for use by the humans. It is unknown what capabilities those ships will have, nor how long it will take before their fleet is operational. Iliath nodded, but did not thank the AI. One did not thank a machine. The backup plan had become the primary strategy, though not in the way the humans assumed. The plan was not to freeze Earth. In fact, the plan was to not freeze Earth. Threatening massive disruption to human society, threatening mass deaths, was the objective. If the planet froze and billions of humans died, the remaining human authorities might be tempted to trigger their elder weapons and wipe out all life in the galaxy. That must be avoided. The plan was to threaten Earth, to force the new human fleet to react. The AIs of the strategic planning section determined that humans would almost certainly bring their warships to Earth to provide cover while they attempted to mitigate the effects of the cloud. Those warships were the objective of Rikard's plan, the reason for the entire task force. Lure the human fleet to their home star system where they could be engaged and destroyed. Humans would be shocked by seeing their new fleet wiped out. they would fall into despair, knowing those ships could not be replaced. Loss of foolish hope would, according to the predictive AIs of the strategic planning section, prompt the humans to petition for peace. They would approach the Maxalks to cut a deal that would exclude the Rindaloo. It was, she had to admit, a good plan. Less risky than engaging the ghost ship, and a small group of obsolete Jarraptha warships certainly could not challenge the might of the Hegemony fleet. It made sense that humans would seek to protect their home world, and even the support of Valkyrie could not save their new fleet from certain destruction. There was only one thought nagging at the back of Captain Ilyith's mind as she watched the fuel tank indicator approach the full mark. So far, nothing the humans had done was predictable. She had a very bad feeling that whatever the humans did next, it could not be predicted by the powerful artificial intelligences of the strategic planning section, or by anyone else in the galaxy. Ross, Perkins, and I went aboard the battleship Pacific to meet with Zhao, present their plan to deploy the Legion, and my plan to strike Ratanavir. I needed to emphasize that Ratanavir was just the opening salvo in a campaign to hit the enemy harder than they could take. There is a difference between the letter of written orders and how they are actually implemented. In almost every case, no operational order, no matter how detailed, can explain every element of how a plan is to be interpreted and implemented. In every case, there are people involved, and people are complicated. What I told Ross was true. I did not need to get Admiral Zhao's permission to do what I thought necessary to protect our homeworld. It was also true that I did not have to be an asshole about it. The guy is a vice admiral. In the U.S. Navy, he would wear 3 stars. In the Chinese Navy, for whatever reason, their equivalent to a NATO rank code OF-8 has only 2 stars on the shoulder boards. Zhao had proven himself over a lifetime of service and had the confidence of UNEF command. That's why they assigned him the monumental task of developing Earth's first fleet of warships. He not only needed to get our new ships up to speed, he also had to train crews to operate and maintain them. Before that, he had to manage the task of figuring out how best to operate the ships of the new UN Navy, then develop doctrine, training materials, and implement a training program. If we still relied on paper instruction manuals, we might have cut down entire forests of trees on Jia Yuguan to document everything. I mentioned the Herculean task facing Zhao because I for sure wouldn't want to get stuck with that job. The guy had my respect, and I wanted advice and assistance from him and his staff. According to Sims and Chang and Skippy and Smythe and pretty much everyone I asked, I tended to veer from under to overconfidence with little in between. Doubting myself was much more common, but my rare moments of arrogance always got me and the merry band of pirates into trouble. I presented my plan to force the kiddies to clean up the mess they made in our home solar system. Zhao had a reputation for being kinda cautious and unimaginative, and he asked a lot of questions about my plan to strike the Ratanavir shipyard. He liked the idea, and I could see in his eyes that making the Maxalks disperse the cloud was one option he and his staff had not considered. He also agreed that realistically, only the Maxalks of the Rindaloo had the technology and the resources to prevent the cloud from freezing Earth. Let's just say that the spiders were not inclined to help us, so that left the Maxalks. To my surprise, and apparently to the surprise of his staff, he agreed we should hit the Maxalks at the earliest opportunity and that Ratanavir appeared to be a good first target.
"Every day we do nothing, the enemy grows more bold," he explained.
I was caught unprepared for his sudden, unexpected agreement. Going into the meeting, Ross had warned me to be patient and to make sure I knew what I was talking about. I sputtered. Zhao's impassive face cracked a smile.
"Colonel Bishop, the people of Earth need a win right now. Get one for them. And," he added without a smile, "do not lose your ship. Ratanavir represents a low-risk opportunity. See that it stays that way."
"Yes, sir." I saluted and got out of there before he could remember what a reckless jackass I am and change his mind. During our meeting, Zhao had strongly suggested, one change to my plan of action. I agreed to the change. It made matters more complicated, but he convinced me it was something we had to do. That is why, when I took Valkyrie back out 4 days later,
we went through the wormhole and turned toward Earth instead of setting course for Maxalt's territory.
Chapter 4. Valkyrie went through the backstop wormhole and performed a quick recon of our home solar system in case we needed to reverse course and get the hell out of there. If the Dutchman had been with us, I would have ordered that ship to go through backstop first. It was better to risk our old star carrier than to risk Skippy being captured. Plus, the latest version of the Flying Dutchman was a super stealthy sensor platform, much harder to detect than our massive battlecruiser. In a way, it was good that the Dutchman had to stay a Jaguar until Nagatha could get the supply ships up to speed on the refit process. Our old star carrier was commanded by Captain Nakamura. He had been with me as my executive officer during Valkyrie shakedown cruise after we returned to Earth following our triumphant kick-ass tour of the galaxy. Nakamura is a good guy, very professional, and I appreciated his many good qualities. But the truth is, he and I never clicked like I did with my previous XOs. Chang, Desai, Sims, even Reed when she filled in. They all knew me and how to work with me. With Nakamura, I had to figure out how to work with him. Part of the problem, a big part of the reason we never developed more than an awkward working relationship, is that I knew his time aboard Valkyrie was limited. There wasn't time or opportunity or even much of a point to building a rapport with my revolving door of XOs at that time. UNEF Command had wanted a string of people in the Valkyrie XO's chair because we had ambitions to build a whole fleet of starships, and truthfully, our bench of people with experience in command of ships was rather thin. Basically, the list was me, Chang, and Sims. Chang had been kicked upstairs in the UNEF organization. Sims wanted to get back to her logistics specialty. That left me in command of Valkyrie and Nakamura with zero space combat experience to handle the Dutchman. Someday we would have a whole fleet of starships with experienced captains and crews. Until then, we had to manage as best we could. Why am I rambling on about personnel and manpower issues? Because the reason we went back to Earth makes me uncomfortable. We weren't there to help, not directly. We couldn't do anything to make the situation on our homeworld better, to remove the threat that was literally hanging over their heads. The cloud was still not visible other than as a very faint discoloration across a band of the sky. It was so thin that while looking at it through one of Valkyrie's few actual viewports, I thought it was just a smudge on the clear composite material. Crap. Something like that would doom our homeworld to